Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Bernard Madoff cheat his clients out of billions of dollars in assets? And who else involved in the family business should have known what was going on? The 71-year-old former chairman of NASDAQ is currently serving a 150-year prison sentence for defrauding his asset management clients, many of whom had considered themselves friends of Madoff, his wife Ruth, and their two sons. As chief investigative correspondent for ABC News, Brian Ross has been covering this story since it broke late last year and has just written a comprehensive account of how Madoff pulled off the largest Ponzi scheme in history until the tanking stock market dried up the supply of investors willing to inject the capital he needed to keep up the charade. His new book is called The Madoff Chronicles, Inside the Secret World of Bernie and Ruth. Brian, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
I have to say, the most chilling thing about your depiction of Bernie Madoff is how utterly remorseless he seems to be. When one of his victims committed suicide over the loss of all his money, Madoff scoffed at him.
He did, and it was a French banker who had put in about $1.5 billion of his money, but more important to him, his client's money, and he felt dishonored and betrayed, and he felt he had done his clients a bad turn, and he took his life. Madoff was under house arrest at the time, and when he was told of the death of this banker who he knew, he said, you know, that guy, he couldn't pick a stock if his life depended on it, as if it was really, the victim was weak, and Bernie, of course, was strong, and the irony, the double irony, of course, is that Madoff never picked a stock either. He always bought the stocks well after the market had closed because he never actually traded the stocks. He just recorded fictional trades, and thousands of people thought they were getting rich.
Talk a little bit about how his career and how he got started in finance.
He started in the early 1960s, fresh out of college, at a folding table in his apartment with his wife, Ruth. And according to what he told people who visited him right after his arrest, he began as a crook almost immediately. And he told them, I had a year or two of sleepless nights scamming people, and then I realized I could pull off this Ponzi scheme, which is a scheme where you essentially... you pay people huge rates of return based on not the stocks you pick, but on the fact that you have new investors and you're using their money, and it's a rat race. You've got to keep adding investors to keep the scheme going. But he discovered that people weren't pulling their money out. They were very happy, and he thought it could go on forever, apparently.
Yeah, he never had an exit strategy. He sort of assumed that he would die with this secret.
Exactly, exactly. And someone said, or the world would end, he said. And it turns out that he was asked, well, that would mean maybe if the world ended, your wife and your children, everybody would be dead. And he said, yeah, I know. That was his strategy to get out.
Let's talk about Ruth Madoff, because although she continues to insist that she was ignorant of everything illegal that was taking place, she is, by all accounts, a very intelligent woman and perhaps smarter than her husband.
Exactly. She was involved. Her father helped steer early clients to her husband's investment advisory business. And at the same time, she had this sort of, she almost relished the idea of being thought as involved because she didn't want to be thought of as a dumb blonde. Talk to criminologists about Madoff, and they say someone like Madoff needs a partner who he can control and manipulate. And that would be Ruth. And her own sons don't speak to her anymore. They consider her to be an enabler of the scheme. And she thinks their behavior is unconscionable. So the whole family has fallen apart. But she has remained loyal to her husband, told her husband that you're the only man I've ever loved. You're still that suntanned, handsome lifeguard who swept me off my feet when I was 16. So it's a strange but... true love story that reminded me a lot as I looked into it of Bonnie and Clyde, the bank robbers of the 1930s.
So every day Bernie Madoff would check the balance in this one particular account he had with Chase Bank, and that was the account where he would warehouse this money that he was stealing.
Right, and that's all he really cared about, was whether there was still enough money, because that was the account. He wasn't doing any trades, so it was not really of any interest to him how the market closed, because he, at the end of the month, would just pick stocks and for his fictional trades. But he had to know if more money was going out that was coming in, because that was the cushion, the only cushion. And at times, it was in the billions of dollars. As the financial tsunami hit everybody last year, he realized that cushion was disappearing. And he knew that by the end of the year, There were lots of large institutional investors who wanted to take their money out, withdraw. That had never really happened before. And for the most part, it was because people were not dissatisfied with Bernie, but they had margin calls and other requirements for the money elsewhere, and they had no choice. And he was desperate, and he went around to close friends, people he had known for years, and got them to invest hundreds of millions of dollars more in a desperate attempt to keep the scam going.
He was so ignorant of what was really taking place in the stock market that if people would sort of ask him a question out at a cocktail party or something, he would say, let me ask my sons about that because they handle this. Because he really didn't know.
Right. Yeah. And yet the sons were in what was considered the legitimate part of the Madoff business. There was a large trading desk, and it looked very high-tech, and about 100 traders on the floor, and his office and his conference room overlooked that. And if you were to visit Madoff, as many people did, to try to figure out if they should invest their money, they would see that and be very, very impressed. And they never really realized that that had nothing to do with his investment advisory business. That was two floors down in a messy kind of hovel with a locked door that only a few people had access to. Or people were wearing cutoffs and jeans, and that was where the center of the scam was. And no one was allowed down there except a handful of people who had the right key and card.
Brian Ross is my guest. He's chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. His new book is called The Madoff Chronicles, Inside the Secret World of Bernie and Ruth. Brian, was there anything in the activity in that Chase account that should have tipped off the people at the bank that something was amiss?
A lot of it, because one of his fictions was, because his sons would say and others would say, where are the actual trades? And his fiction was, well, our office in London actually carries out and facilitates the trades through the European markets. So on a regular basis, there'd be these huge transfers of money, $100, $200 million at a time, between New York and London and then right back. It was a kind of sophisticated check-kiting scheme that he had that gave the impression of lots of activity. Now, that should have triggered, many believe, reporting by the banks that this was suspicious and unusual, with the same amount going out and coming back on a repeated basis. It never did.
And there were, I don't know, half a dozen times where he was investigated for certain things. Why did no one put the pieces together?
That is, I'd say, for me, the remaining mystery. You know, as an investigative reporter, I'm really suspicious. At this point, the SEC's best defense, and that's what they say, is essentially we were incompetent. We were inexperienced. We had the wrong people. We didn't ask the right questions. So incompetence is their defense, and certainly it's truthful, because that would be the best explanation. I mean, others might suggest that someone had to be on the take for this to be like this. But in essence, Chris, he was a Wall Street big shot. He'd been the chairman of the NASDAQ exchange three separate terms. He was known all over Wall Street. He gave lots of money to prominent politicians. And when it came down to taking his word, or the word of somebody who might have complained or had filed kind of whistleblower complaints against him, they always took his word. There's one telling scene in 2006 when yet another person had come forward to say, what he's doing is impossible, the trades just doesn't make any sense. They actually asked Madoff, where are all the stocks you hold? Where are the equities? And, of course, there were none. But he said, well, they're held by the Depository Trust Company, which is a large firm that holds stocks and equities for investment firms. And you can check with them. And it was a Friday. And he felt that by Monday he would be arrested because there were no stocks. And they simply made a phone call. They would know that they held nothing for Bernie Madoff. They never called. They never checked it out. And at that point, he told people he had about $20 billion, with a B, dollars in that Chase account. If they had caught him then, the investors would have received probably 75, 80 cents for every dollar they put in. Right now they're looking at about 5 to 10 cents.
Can you talk for a minute about how the Madoffs spent their wealth as it grew?
He affected a kind of old money style with lavish spending. It was never flashy, which is interesting. He had an interior decorator who worked very closely with, and he was compulsive about the appearance of subtle earth tones in the offices. He even had approval right down to the picture frames on people's desks. They were allowed one photograph, and he would approve the frame. It had to be just right. He had a fabulous two-story penthouse in Manhattan, about 13 blocks from the office, a fleet of limousines taken back and forth for 13 blocks. They had an oceanfront estate out in the Hamptons in the village of Montauk, which was recently sold. They had another waterfront mansion down in Palm Beach on the Intercoastal Waterway, a villa in France, boats, essentially three different shares of private jets. That's how they traveled. And it was a life of great luxury, far from the upbringing he had in the neighborhood of Queens, and when that was only something he could dream about. But he realized that dream, and it's, you know, he has blamed everybody but himself for all this. But the fact is, the fact is that he did this to make himself rich, and he used that money as well to essentially bribe employees, a handful of the inner circle, people with no college education who became the chief financial officer, or they had jobs and salaries, $2 to $3 million a year they only would never have a chance of getting except with Madoff. But part of it was they had to go along with the crime.
Yeah, tell us about that chief financial officer, because he was a guy that struck some of the other employees who were sort of on the up and up as almost a mob character.
Yeah, Frank DePasquale. Now, Frank DePasquale never had finished even the first year of college. He came in, he's always wearing gold chains, and unlike the others in the Madoff Empire, who suit and tie, he was in cutoffs, flip-flops sometimes, shirt hanging out, but he was the key to Madoff's scam. He was the one who, when investors came in with questions, then Frank would show up suit and tie, and they'd put on this whole phony production of where the stocks were, and he was important there. He made up to $3 million a year. He had unlimited use of a corporate Platinum American Express card for personal travel and expenses. He got money from Madoff, really from the investors, for his huge yacht. His yacht captain was on the payroll of the Madoff firm. And he's a man who's now admitted, you know, he went for the greed. And he got caught up in it and now faces a long term in prison. He had agreed to cooperate with the government, and the prosecutors had said they'd let him get out on bail, and the judge rejected the deal, so he's locked up right now and not very happy about it.
We should say, by the way, in one of those stranger-than-fiction details, the name of Bernie Madoff's yacht was the Bull?
The Bull. It was his motif. He had pictures of bulls. He had stuffed bulls. He had the Bull II, the Little Bull, and the Sitting Bull, other boats that he had around the world.
You mentioned that DePasquale had a personal credit card or a corporate credit card for personal use. And in fact, there were a lot of people within the company that enjoyed the ability to sort of buy whatever they wanted on the company dime.
Yeah, it was a way of Bernie to keep everybody happy. He almost never fired anybody. And those on the inner circle had one of these Platinum American Express cards. And those records were made available to us. And they are really shopping sprees, vacations in Jackson Hole, Paris, really anything and everything, and it was all paid for out of the corporate till, which really was the same account that held the investors' money.
And ultimately, $65 million of people's money disappeared.
Well, it's the figure's interesting, Chris, because that's what people thought they had. Hmm. On the last month of November of last year, the month before Madoff's scheme was exposed, if you added up all the statements people received, they would have totaled $65 billion. Now, the actual money put in over the course of the years may have been close to 20 or 25. The extra 40 were the false profits that Madoff gave them in their accounts. But it's money they thought they had. They lived based on what they saw in those monthly statements, as anybody who has an investment account usually does. It looks very fancy. It looks complicated. No one really challenges it.
Brian Ross is with us. He's chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. His new book is called The Madoff Chronicles, Inside the Secret World of Bernie and Ruth. After we take a break, you can join us on the phone by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Chief Investigative Correspondent for ABC News, Brian Ross. His new book is called The Madoff Chronicles, Inside the Secret World of Bernie and Ruth. If you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I want to go back for a minute, Brian, to this question of the statements. In some ways, this comes across as the most labor-intensive component of everything, because he did individually, for every one of these 4,000 or so clients, every month draw up a statement that made it look like they were earning all this money.
Right, and that really was a key to the scheme, that people received them on a regular basis, and they never really changed. In fact, he had an old computer there. It's called an AS400, I believe, which is outdated, and his own tech people, unaware of the scam, kept saying, we've got to replace that computer, that's no good. But he never would, and they wouldn't understand it, because elsewhere in the office, everything was new and latest and greatest, state-of-the-art. But they couldn't replace that one, because the way it was programmed, he really couldn't bring anybody else in to program it. And the original programmers, we were told, were given about $500,000 each and then went on their way. So the key was producing these statements, and they essentially would... it was like betting on a horse after the race was over. You really couldn't lose. He and DePasquale, at the end of every month, would look at all the stock trades, and they only dealt in the so-called blue chips in their imaginary world, and they'd pick the high point when GE or IBM was selling for the most, and that's when they sold it, or is that the lowest? That's when they bought it, and they always picked the highest and the lowest. And they would just imagine these trades and then reflect them on the statements. And people got them and looked at them. It looked very real, respectable stocks and in and out of U.S. treasuries. And the fact is, if you added up all the trades he was doing, he had a whole complicated set that involved also options and other financial sophisticated products. If you added it all up, at one point he might have owned half of all Coca-Cola stock, which was impossible. But no one ever did. No one ever had that broad perspective. The only ones that could have would have been the SEC, and they never did. They never got there.
And in this pattern of blaming the victim, one of the things that Madoff said after he was finally brought to justice was that he was under all this pressure from his clients to continue providing these amazing numbers.
Absolutely. When he was pleading guilty, it was sort of his explanation that he never apologized until the final day of his sentencing, but at his plea, he said, I was under this pressure from all these people who, he said, I never promised them anything. They just demanded more and more from me. And it was really part and parcel of his mentality to think that it was really, in a way, their fault. Sociologists, criminologists call it sort of the boomerang personality. Anything you throw at them, they throw right back. And it was their fault. They're the ones that are demanding it. They weren't smart. Without him, they would have no money. And in many cases, people did actually end up, at the end of the day, taking out more than they put in, although they still thought they had a lot left.
Because he had led them to believe that there were no restrictions on taking the money out.
Right. And that was a sign of, he did two things. One, you could take your money out whenever you wanted, and it was sort of a bluff, because if people had, he would have been exposed. But and the other thing was, he played very hard to get, Chris. He might tell people, no, I don't think I'll take your money. And people would plead to be let in. And he had people who worked for him, although it was never revealed they were getting paid. But they would say, well, I know Bernie. Maybe I can get you in. Go through me. I'll get you in. And they got commissions for that. But that was part of the sales pitch, was that, playing hard to get. And people thought this couldn't be a scam. I mean, one, the SEC has investigated him. It was well known. He's been given the clean bill of health. Two, he won't take my money. I have to work hard to get in there.
And amazingly, a lot of the people who got caught up in this were people that considered themselves friends, people that Madoff's vacationed with, people Absolutely. That they invited to family weddings and bar mitzvahs.
People on the same charity boards as him, and not to mention all the charities that were almost wiped out because they'd put their money with Madoff. It seemed such a safe haven for funds, a steady 12, 15, 20% a year. He could cheat anybody without a problem. His wife's sister was wiped out. People who were recently widowed would come and see him, and their husbands had been friends with Bernie, had been in the same country club, and one of them told me how he sort of put his arm around her and said, don't you worry, just leave your money with me, we'll take care of you.
What Let's talk about Ruth Madoff for a minute. She, in the beginning, kept the books for him.
Yes.
And how? What sort of association did she maintain with the business as time went on?
Well, she had an office. She was in there 3 or 4 days a week, according to people we talked to. She continued to keep books, although they say it was just the checking account, but she was active. Some would say that the best you could say for her was a kind of willful ignorance. She did begin to take out money near the downfall before anybody else knew it was about to collapse. She was taking out two different lots of $10 and $15 million that she transferred to another account because she knew it was going to collapse. She obviously was in on it at that point. And did she know overall? Some of the things I know she said to Bernie suggest she didn't realize it was that kind of scam. Mm. Lots of people thought he's doing something that's funny, that doesn't smell right. But they always thought that, well, it benefits me. There's something in Wall Street known as front-running, which is illegal, but not that uncommon, apparently, where people, if someone's going to buy a million shares of something and you're placing the order, if you place your own order ahead of that, and you're guaranteed to make a profit because just the million shares will drive up the price. And people thought that Madoff was front-running, and the SEC did at one point, too. And he wasn't, but they thought that was the scam, and so they concluded, I think, that, well, it benefits me. If he gets caught, that's his problem, not mine. And, of course, the scam was slightly different. They were the marks. They just didn't know it.
How did they manage to survive the other big downturns in the market that took place during the time the scam was going on?
Yeah, he almost got wiped out after the September 11th attacks when the market really tanked. And he and a handful of others started moving money back and forth between New York and London, essentially to blow up or exaggerate the amount in the accounts and deal with the withdrawals that were taking place. Because even he was hit by that. And he barely survived, but he did get through it. That was a close call for him, but he got through it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We're talking to Brian Ross, whose new book is called The Madoff Chronicles, Inside the Secret World of Bernie and Ruth. We have an email here from Dale in Plano who asks, what is being done to follow the incompetence trail in the oversight organization, meaning, I guess, the SEC?
The SEC, and there's another group called FINRA, which is sort of the in-house. In my view, not that much. The SEC, nobody's been fired that I know of. The SEC says from now on they're going to actually do double checks. They're going to record the interviews. They're going to do them under oath. In Bernie's case, when he was interviewed, they weren't recorded. They had no record of it, and it was voluntary. And he was able to completely pull the wool over their eyes. He boasted about it to the secretary, who talked with us extensively for the book, about how to treat them, bringing them lots of food, give them anything they want, but they can't leave the conference room. They can't talk to anybody else. If they want a copy of something, make the copy, but make a copy for me. Listen on their phone calls, see where they're going, what they're doing. They had people actually follow them out to lunch. And and these were sort of junior SEC investigators, lawyers, accountants, and they were afraid to challenge him because he would throw around the names of the SEC commissioners who were his buddies. And they were. This is Mr. Madoff, and he's a big man on Wall Street, and that's part of the of his his scam was to keep the SEC off his back. He was always nervous. He knew they were just at any one point one little slip up away from being caught, but he pulled it off. They never caught on to it until he actually told his sons to call the FBI. He turned himself in, essentially.
Let's talk about that moment, because, again, in this really extraordinarily narcissistic way, he assumed that he was doing a good thing for them because they would be able to be perceived as heroes for turning in their father.
Exactly. They say they did not know until he called them in and told them, I'm a fraud, it's all a lie, I have nothing, it's all gone. And they were distraught. And he asked them, but give me a week so I can wrap things up and get everything in order. They went directly to their lawyer. The older son, Mark's wife, is the daughter of a prominent New York lawyer, and he put him in with his firm. And the lawyers there said, we're not giving him anything. And they were talking to federal prosecutors that night about what their father had told them. coincidentally, that was the night of the office Christmas party. And Bernie went to the party with his wife and with his brother, and according to people there, acted not unusual. his wife said, asking people what they were going to do for the holidays, and she said, we're going down to Florida, and it seemed all very normal. At that very moment, the sons were across town in New York talking to federal prosecutors and SEC investigators. Bernie was surprised the sons didn't show up, and then the next morning tried to find them. He called the office, and they weren't taking his phone calls. And then about 8:15, an FBI agent came to his door. He was still in his bathrobe and his pajamas and slippers, and he's a fastidious man who really cares how he dresses. He never would have been dressed like that had he known the FBI was coming. And they asked him, is there any innocent explanation of what you told your sons yesterday? And he said, no, there's not. And they said, well, get dressed. We're taking you downtown. And they did, in handcuffs.
Yeah, and for a while he was handcuffed to his kitchen chair.
Yeah. His lawyer, Ike Sorkin, who was a very prominent New York defense lawyer, had been called by Madoff a few weeks earlier and said, I've got a problem. We need to talk. And they were all set to meet that week. And then he called Sorkin and put it off for another week. And the next, so Sorkin took the day and was down in Washington at his granddaughter's nursery school watching the children recite farmyard tales. And the cell phone rings, and Bernie said, Ike, it's Bernie. I'm handcuffed to a chair in the FBI headquarters. And then he began to say, and I told them, and he said, don't say another word. Stop talking. But by that point, he had given a only partially truthful, but a kind of confession, which certainly implicated him. His goal, it seems, was to try to say, I did this all alone. Nobody else was involved. And no one believed that, but that was his attempt, I guess, at being a decent human being, at least to the co-conspirators.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I spent the better part of probably 20 years in the financial services industry as a principal, as a brokerage firm. And, I mean, I can say that if people say, well, how could this Madoff thing happen? And I can tell you that the auditors that come in, and at the time it was the NASD, now it's FINRA, but and the SEC, I mean, their level of understanding of where to look for the problems is just non-existent. I mean, they were by and large, really bad at what they did. And my other experience was, and I've seen financial frauds throughout my career, was that when the FBI was involved, the more complicated a financial fraud was, the less likely it was to be prosecuted to the very end. Those are my comments. And which, I guess, brings me to the final thing, which I want to say was, so given all of the kind of the incompetence in dealing with something like the Bernie Madoff scandal, you know, how do you then, when we're talking about dealing with systemic risk and regulators to regulate systemic risk, you know, how exactly does anybody think that that's going to work very well? And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Those are really excellent points, and they absolutely mirror everything I've been told about how the regulators who dealt with Madoff, they couldn't understand his basic, complicated but basic strategy, which people on Wall Street did understand. They didn't really get it at all. And when one man in particular, whose boss was asked to figure out how's Madoff making all this money when we're not, when he ran the numbers based on what Madoff had said publicly, he said, well, this is impossible. You can't buy that many options to do what he's doing. It's just technically impossible. Mathematically makes no sense. But he couldn't get that through to the SEC because they didn't have the ability, you know, to understand the concept of what Madoff was doing in the first place and therefore why it was impossible to do it. And the caller, Mike, I think he's absolutely touched on something that is essential with these kinds of sophisticated financial instruments where we count on the government to make sure everything's on the up and up. If the regulators themselves don't understand what's happening, how can they even begin to think that they are able to regulate that and spot fraud and spot these kinds of cons?
Well, I wonder if part of the problem is that if people are skilled enough and knowledgeable enough about the securities industry, they don't want to take a $60,000 government salary. They want to be in the business making millions.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and Madoff used that to his advantage in one of the phone calls that was recorded that we got our hands on. He's telling, you know, these guys don't be, they're not that smart, and all they want to do is get a job at a brokerage house and be compliance officers. They want to spend 4 or 5 years at the SEC, get their tickets punched, and then move on and make some real money.
Is there any protection whatsoever from the SIPC for the victims of this?
Well, there's some, and it's becoming the source of great controversy and lawsuits in itself. The victims feel doubly victimized. The SIPC, they call it. They are not, they say, like the FDIC. Just because you have a statement from your brokerage that says you have $500,000, they don't necessarily credit that. They will only reimburse for what you actually put in, and your opportunity cost, what the money could have made, is not factored in. Whereas if you had a bank fraud and the bank said you had $1 million, you have $1 million, the FDIC would reimburse up to 100 or so, or 200, depending on the case. But here, SIPC is really at war with many of the victims. And in fact, the bankruptcy trustee, Irving Picard, also is running the SIPC investigation. In many cases, you know, their position is, well, if you took out more money than you put in at the end of the day, not only are you going to get nothing from us, but we want some of that money back. So it is people are very unhappy with how SIPC is operated. And the fact is, they don't have enough money in their accounts right now to handle a full reimbursement for all the Madoff victims.
So this would essentially bankrupt the SIPC.
Yeah. They have lines of credit guaranteed by Congress, and they can put a levy, a new tax or set of dues on the brokerage houses. Then that's where the money comes from initially. I mean, brokers and dealers kick in something. So customers feel like, well, if something goes wrong, I'm covered. And the fact is, you may not be. Their limits are up to $500,000, and there are questions that have been raised in this case as to, you know, what would they do about actual fraud? If you thought you had money that had accrued interest over the years, are you owed just what you put in, or are you owed what you thought you had?
Brian Ross is my guest. He's chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. His new book is called The Madoff Chronicles, Inside the Secret World of Bernie and Ruth. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brian Ross, who is chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. His new book is called The Madoff Chronicles, Inside the Secret World of Bernie and Ruth. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. And that is where we find Patrick in Richardson. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Once again, excellent show.
Thank you.
Mr. Ross, it's a pleasure having you on the KER station here.
Thank you very much. It's
watching
great to
you
be
for
here.
A lot of years. Listen, I was wondering if you could answer, did Bernie Madoff ever hire an executive protection company for the sole purpose of protecting himself from any of his clients, from any type of retribution whatsoever to his personal safety? I'll take my question off the air. And once again, great show, and it was a pleasure, Brian.
Thanks for your call.
He did after he was initially arrested and then released on house arrest. He did have a firm he hired, paid for with money that was really stolen money. And they had two purposes. One was to essentially enforce the provisions of the house arrest. He had to wear an ankle bracelet and could only leave at certain times. But also the real concern was, and he wore a bulletproof vest when he went to court during this period, was that one of the victims or a relative of the victims might take revenge because people were wiped out, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars disappeared, and lots of people who were forced to sell their homes, couldn't pay their mortgages, were watching in horror as Madoff continued to live the life of luxury in his penthouse apartment. They just couldn't believe it, and the anger was so great about him, and the betrayal so deep that he did have concerns for his life, and certainly his security people did. That's why he was wearing a bulletproof vest.
How did Ruth Madoff walk out of this whole thing with $2.5 million?
Excellent question. They wanted to avoid a fight. They, I believe, could have proved or prepared to prove that every dollar she had was a result of her husband's scam. In the end, the federal government said $2.5 million, we're not going to contest that. The fact is that people are lining up to sue her for that remaining amount, and I think the bankruptcy trustee will seek to take every last penny she has. That $2.5 million is by no means safe and secure for her.
And she's literally these days eating like bean burritos and toast. And
so she says. She can't find much sympathy, you know, where she goes. Her hair salon in New York kicked her out because there were too many of the victims who didn't want to be in the same place as she was. Her own sister was bankrupted by this. She's found they've kind of patched things up. But her sons do not speak to her, and she can't even see the grandchildren. She's been trying to go around behind the backs of her sons to the sons' ex-wives in the hope to see the grandchildren. And it's just, you know, it's as ugly as could be. She never, from what we've been told, expressed any real regret about what her husband did until, actually, frankly, we started doing some stories about it, and she issued a statement saying, of course, I'm appalled, and this is not the Bernie Madoff I knew. But the fact is she continues to adore her husband, visits him on a regular basis, down at the federal prison in North Carolina, where he's spending the rest of his days, I guess. He has a 150-year sentence.
And her justification for not having made a statement earlier was that she wanted to wait until the trial proceedings were over for Bernie.
Apparently, yeah. You know, it's that's what she said. She could have said something a lot earlier and did not, chose not to. And I know from what she told people privately that she blamed, like her husband, she blamed others. She was upset. She thought that it was people were piling on and justice couldn't be fair. And she also told people that she, in a way, she kind of felt free, and she felt her husband felt free, no longer condemned to have to pull off the scam. And she was kind of excited that she'd be cleaning her own apartment for once. That was kind of liberating for her in a way. So.
We have
inside the secret world of Bernie and Ruth.
We have an email here from Althea who writes, "It is somewhat sickening to listen to all this, but I appreciate getting some clarity. What is the lesson for someone like me who has nothing to do with it for the future? The bottom line, for an ordinary person trying to manage finances?"
It's pretty simple. When you get those statements, you might make sure they are legitimate. There's nothing wrong with asking questions just because they're appear to be successful and have been successful. Bernie Madoff was a very, very big name, and that enough was good enough for people, but, you know, it shouldn't have been. But at the same token, I think it's hard to blame individual investors, but I guess the takeaway is if you're suspicious, it's like when people tell you when you go to the hospital. Just demand, ask questions. If people had asked, who does your accounting of Bernie Madoff, they would have learned it's a guy that had a one-room operation about 50 miles outside New York, who couldn't possibly be in the position to provide meaningful accounting and oversight to a firm that was handling $65 billion. You know, one person couldn't do that. And if enough people had asked questions, this might have been exposed sooner. So I, you know, as a reporter, that's my job, is to ask questions. I always tell people, don't be afraid to ask questions. You won't look, you know, there are no stupid questions.
One of the things, I think the book does really a remarkable job of explaining the entire ugly story, but as a little bonus, you reproduce in it a copy of Bernie Madoff's black book, his little black book. Can you tell us what was in that?
This was what he deemed to be his most important contacts. Every year he would go to the French leather goods store Hermès for about $500 by a little tiny dress book, his little black book, literally black leather, and then he'd handwrite the names of his most important people. Then he'd give his secretary the book and have her type a copy, so in case he lost it, it was still there. She gave us a copy of that. She also gave it to the FBI, and so we've reproduced it. And it shows people in there who were some of his biggest investors slash victims, who he cheated, but he had all their phone numbers. He showed people who are now under investigation, the people in the inner circle, and others whose names are about to emerge. Under M, there are seven or eight women who were masseuses, professional escorts, who he had in various parts of the world when he traveled. And that's what that little black book is. So it's interesting. About, I think there are about 154 names in there, and those are his people closest to him, or at least he thought so.
We should say that his secretary, who has been very cooperative both with media reporters and with investigators,
right.
Was a victim in her own right.
She was. She felt so betrayed because she was often used by Bernie as an excuse, like, well, you don't think that I'm crooked. Eleanor has been here for 25 years. If there's anything wrong, you know Eleanor, she wouldn't be here. And then the morning he was arrested, she began taking the phone calls from all these people over the years that she knew so well who would say to her, Eleanor, just tell us this is not true. Tell us this can't be. And she was in tears. And when I first met her, I think she cried for about a half hour as she tried to tell this, to get going, to say hello, to tell the story. Hmm. And she's been devastated and has essentially dedicated herself to do all she can to go after her boss and try to help the people who were ripped off, who she became close to. And she admits, she said, I loved Bernie Madoff. I thought I had a wonderful life. You know, Madoff would throw rather elaborate parties several times a year for the employees, and they all thought he was generous, and many of them had their money because they weren't aware of the scam, including Eleanor. She ends up having to take it out and pay for other expenses, so she didn't lose that much. But she could have just as easily, and he never stopped her.
Let's go next on the line to Larry in Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Two questions about the enforcement. One, is there any sniff that the people sent out as investigators, who we know to be incompetent, amateur, rookies, first, that they were sent out in just for that reason, that they were going to not see anything? And two, why not just let sunshine prevail? Publish their names, and good luck with them in their legal careers. Take their lumps.
I think those are very good questions, and I think, you know, the most sophisticated sort of fix, of course, is to send people in who just can't handle it, and they bungle it, and it just looks like it's a bunch of incompetence. And I haven't seen evidence of that, but I am suspicious myself. I think those are unanswered questions. The Inspector General for the Securities Exchange Commission, David Kotz, did an investigation and says that he found no evidence of that. But I know there are several people who were high-level SEC figures who were in that little black book. They told me they didn't know why they're in the little black book, and they never had done any favors for Bernie. Others say it was just more than a direct payoff. They were in awe of the man and his power and his wealth, and you know, maybe they sought to get employment one day.
What's happened, Brian, to the legitimate arm of the business that was run by the sons, Mark and Andrew?
That's been sold off to another company. Many of the employees will keep their jobs. Others won't. But that's now back in business under a new name and no longer a Madoff operation. They've tried to sell off all they can. They've put the homes up for sale. The U.S. Marshals seized them, and they've put them on the market. And they're hoping that, you know, maybe at the end of the day they might be able to recover a billion or 2 billion maybe. But that's not going to even come close to meaning much to the people who lost their livelihoods.
And there were a lot of people who invested money with Bernie Madoff that would have seemed pretty financially sophisticated.
Yeah, indeed they were. And in those cases, I think you have to ask a different set of questions. How could you have thought this worked? Is there anybody else you know in the history of man who every year has made that profit on the stock market, good or bad? And I guess people say, well, Warren Buffett and certain other people, you know, George Soros. But even they have had bad years. Bernie never had a bad year. And that should have stuck out, it seems. And that's been one of the arguments in lawsuits filed by the trustee, that some of his biggest investors, you know, knew or should have known. And how could they have not seen? For instance, some of the phony trades were booked, if you look closely, on days the stock market wasn't open, federal holidays or Saturdays. You know, was anybody paying any attention at all, or is it just such a wonderful thing you didn't want to ask any questions?
Yeah, let's talk about those people who should have known. There were a number of individuals that, like the man in France who ultimately committed suicide, were sort of booking their clients through Madoff's agency.
Right. And one of the biggest ones, the single biggest, was this group up called Fairfield Greenwich, two wealthy men up in Greenwich, Connecticut. And they had about $7.5 billion of their clients' money there. And what happened there was that usually they had to pay Madoff a fee for him to take their clients' money. Madoff never charged a fee. He waived the fee. So for them, that was extra money on top. They were making $100 million a year or more in just salaries because they had access to Madoff. And there were so many red flags there. In fact, when the SEC began to investigate, they came to interview the people at Fairfield Greenwich, and Madoff was allowed to call the key guy who was going to be interviewed and sort of prep him for the SEC's interview, what to say when they ask about me. And they recorded that phone call, and in the book, kind of recount how he coached the witness before the SEC got to him.
Are investigators completely satisfied that there is no little pool of money hiding in the Caymans or in Switzerland?
I think there's still some money in Switzerland. I've heard some in Africa, maybe. Maybe $600 million to $1 billion is the target amount right now. But a lot of it, was recycled back, as it would be in a Ponzi scheme, to the people who invested. And people who invested early probably came out ahead. And the ones that put money in near the end, they did not come out ahead.
Can this happen again?
I think it can. I think it can. I don't think the SEC still has the ability to pick up on this. And, a good scam always works best when the people who are investing kind of think there might be something a little bit funny about it. They don't want to ask too many questions, don't want to raise any flags. And that happened here, certainly. And I don't think that anybody in the government would tell you this is they stopped this or they're are systems in place to prevent it from happening. And your best advice, going back to your question, what's the takeaway? Just ask a lot of questions. Don't be afraid to, or don't be hesitant. Don't think that you're not smart enough. The fact is, those are all important. The simple, fundamental questions here would have exposed the scheme a lot earlier.
Are there specific regulatory changes being proposed within the securities industry that might have made a difference had they been in existence before?
I think here it's a question of enforcement. He never registered as a broker-dealer until just 2 years ago, even though he had, he had to have over, I think it's 20 clients. He had 4,500, but he lied about that, and they only caught up with that at the very end. And even when they realized that he had lied, they still took his word on everything else. And not necessarily they need new laws, they just need better people enforcing the laws.
Of all the things that you discovered in reporting this, what surprised you the most?
I guess in the end, the Madoff as a man is such a master liar, and his lack of remorse or shame or guilt on his part. Just every time I heard another example of that, an anecdote of that, it was just, to me, I just couldn't understand that, how he could ruin so many lives and not be that bothered by it, and sort of looking forward to prison like a new opportunity, kind of like boot camp when he was in the military.
Brian Ross is chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. His new book is called The Madoff Chronicles, Inside the Secret World of Bernie and Ruth. Brian, sad story, but very well told. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris, very much. It was a pleasure being here.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.